Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. It's a great honor to have
you. You're listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network. News for your soul. Life-changing broadcasts to souls around the world since January 1997.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show. Next up on News for the Soul, Be Empowered, Be Inspired, Raymond Posch. Let's bring him on to reintroduce himself, his show, and what's up for today.
I am Raymond Posch, your spiritual life coach and host for this hour. Welcome. Know that I am sending you empowerment and inspiration, love and light. Today is part three of the book, The Essential Path by Neil Donald Walsh. The book is an important one because it summarizes much of the conversation from Conversations with God, Book 4. The two books both extend the third invitation from God, which is Awaken the Species. So today I will continue to read from The Essential Path. Because each chapter is inspired, it is an important teaching that we need in order to awaken. We cannot awaken the human species overnight. We must each take responsibility to awaken ourselves to a knowing that we are a spiritual being that is a part of the one being. We must come to know that we are one with the wholeness of life, which some people call God, and live from that knowing. Chapter 24, The Key. There could be one final stumbling block in the way of some people fully embracing the idea that they are one with all others in the world. Are we one with those who have done terrible things that we would never ever do? Are we to accept that we are unified with those who do the opposite of everything that we call good and loving and humane? Even if the idea of our oneness reached critical mass and we created a society where horrific behavior would be almost entirely eliminated, what about the very few among us, the tiny minority, who might still act in such ways? And what about those many more who would continue to do so under today's present social conditions, while our species is waiting to reach critical mass with the idea of its singularity? This is another very fair question for sure. The answer is that it is possible for human beings to embrace their oneness with even those who might be labeled by some the worst of our species, and the key to making this decision easy may be summarized in one word. I'll give that to you in just a bit. But first, a preamble. An understanding of our oneness does not call upon us to embrace the notion of sameness. The words inseparable and identical are not synonymous. No one is suggesting that because we are all one, we are all the same. The question then is, can we accept that there is a part of the unified us that individuals within that unified us do not find attractive or acceptable? This question hits closer to home when it is asked in this way. Is there a part of you that you have ever found unattractive or unacceptable? If your answer is no, then you might have a difficult time embracing the notion that other people who exhibit behaviors that are unacceptable to you are one with you, and that you are one with them. Yet, If you can remember a time when you have been or done something unattractive or unacceptable, then you may be able to understand how a person could do even horrible things, things that you would never do, and you can begin to consider the understandings of Capra and many other physicists who tell us that everything is one thing, even though everything is not the same thing. A spiritual teacher of mine once put this into marvelous perspective when she invited me to bring to mind those whom I judge to have acted in horrible ways. She challenged me to ponder how I think those I've judged might answer if they were asked what she called life's most compassionate question. What hurts you so much that you feel you have to hurt others in order to heal it? When I explored this question deeply, I found the key that opened me to seeing others in an entirely different way, because the question presumes that at the root of every person is inborn goodness, and that this is the place where we are all one. This is the part of each other that we share. If others have stepped away from this part of themselves because of their pain, that doesn't mean that this part of themselves doesn't exist. It means that they have lost sight of it, but not that they have lost possession of it. Here then is the key, in one word, compassion. Suddenly I found a way to not feel that I wanted to condemn others, not even those who have been called the worst among us. It happened the moment I gave thought to all they must have gone through in their lives to lead them to so completely abandon their true nature and do what they did. This does not justify their actions, nor does it mean that we condone them, but it does mean that we can understand them. Then we can rise above the urge to condemn and even demonstrate mercy. Too much to ask? More than might be appropriate, given that some people are actually trying to kill us? Well, let's see. On May 13, 1981, a man named Mehmet Ali Akka shot Pope John Paul II repeatedly at close range as the Pope was traveling in an open car through St. Peter's Square in Vatican City. The assassination attempt left the Pope in great pain and very critical condition. The man was tackled, captured, tried, and sentenced to life in prison. Though seriously injured and suffering acute blood loss from the 4 bullet wounds, 2 in his lower intestine, 1 in his right arm, and 1 in his left hand, the Pope recovered and then asked all Catholics to pray for Akka, saying that he had sincerely forgiven his assailant. To accentuate the point, the pontiff 2 years later visited Akka in his cell. The two had a quiet conversation, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Pope posed some version of life's most compassionate question. Whatever was said, the pair became friends, shook hands warmly, and the Pope gave the man his papal blessing. He blessed the man who tried to kill him. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Wait, the story doesn't end there. In 2000, the pontiff requested of the civil authorities that Akka be pardoned. That request was granted. Many people might have found it difficult, if not impossible, to do what Pope John Paul II did. That is because we are, as a species, so very young. As explained earlier, we are, on the scale of the universe, barely out of our infancy. Yet, as our species matures spiritually, we will come to a profound understanding that will allow us to experience even more clearly our oneness with everyone. And we will also see another enormous truth. Every act is an act of love. That was separated and bold-faced to highlight its importance on humanity's spiritual journey, a journey on which you are embarked more determinedly and consciously than ever in this very moment. Lest you think that all you are reading here has come to you by accident. You did not chance upon this book or this show. You did not happen to see it. You knew at some very deep level that it offered for all of humanity what so many of us are looking for, a way out of this morass, a swath through the thicket, a stepping stone. Chapter 25, The Stepping Stone. It is true categorically and without exception, now and throughout all of human history, that there is not a single act, choice, or decision made by any human being that did not arise out of love. In some cases, deeply distorted love, yes. In some very sad instances, mangled, twisted expressions of love, yes. But even the most heinous crime, the most horrible offense, was an expression of someone's love for something. When explored deeply, the accuracy of this statement is confirmed. It is spiritual teachers who have told us love is all there is. This is the foundation and the basis of the most important insight that concluded the previous chapter, and it is a stepping stone on the evolutionary path of our species. If what so many spiritual teachers have said is true, if the pure energy and the essential essence of the universe that makes up the whole of the universe is what is called, in human language, love, then all that exists must emerge from it and must be an expression of it. What then is fear? What of anger? What of hatred? What of evil? What of violence and killing? Surely these can't be expressions of love. But they are. If one didn't love something, one wouldn't fear anything. If one didn't love something, one wouldn't be angry about its opposite. If a person or a group didn't love something desperately, some principle, some doctrine, some idea, some way of life, some person, or some physical possession, they couldn't even begin to think of using desperate measures as a means of getting it, keeping it, or protecting it. If they didn't love something intensely, they could never be angry about either not having it or having it taken away from them. Thieves act out of love. Terrorists act out of love. People who commit crimes of passion act out of love. Again, to be clear, this doesn't condone their actions, but it does explain them. There is something, some object, experience, or outcome that some love so much that they desperately want to have it. And because they know of or think that there is no other way to get it, they steal, they injure, they abuse, they kill. The problem is not that human beings do not love. The problem is that too many human beings act out their love in ways that they themselves would never welcome. Put simply, not enough of us have learned how to do unto others as we would have done unto us. You and I may not have done horrible, horrible things, but we each have done some things in our life that produced, on a much lower level, the same kind of result. Injury to another, and for the same reason, because we have expressed our love for someone or something in a way that hurt someone else. Perhaps it was being right that we loved. Perhaps it was having our way. Perhaps it was power or wealth or a particular possession. Perhaps it was a particular experience or being with a particular person. Whatever it was our love of this that produced the hurting of another. Most of us have done this at least once in our life. The only difference between us and others, other than the scale of things, is that we felt sure in the moment that we made our choice that our actions were understandable, or at least forgivable. All's fair in love and war, we were told, in the earliest known origin of that sentiment found in poet John Lyly's novel, Effuse, The Anatomy of Wit, way back in 1578. That's how long we've held that idea. The point, love as the essential essence of the universe, is very powerful and can produce highly impactful outcomes. It is important, then, to take great care in our expression of love. Yes, it may sound simplistic and jejune to say it, but it deserves being said nonetheless, because clearly there are still not enough people who understand it. Just as nuclear energy can be used in a way that heats a city or destroys a city, the energy of love can be used in a way that heals or hurts both people and the planet. Yet behavior that destroys or injures would never be conceived of, much less acted out, if the people of Earth held as their most sacred belief that we are spiritual beings physically manifesting and one essence manifesting individually. And a person who fully understands this would respond to any deeply injuring act against another by asking themselves how the perpetrator would respond to a slightly altered version of life's most compassionate question. What have you loved so much in your life that you feel you have to hurt others in order to experience it, protect it, or keep it? When we search for the answer of this question, we see clearly, if sadly, that their acts were ultimately sponsored by love. Deeply distorted love, yes. Not condoned or improved of because of the explanation, no. But understood, and thus held in the mind of God, and in our mind if we choose God to be experienced as a part of us, in a different way. Chapter 26, The Different Way. Can our species find a different way to be human? Can we create a new personal ethic, a new personal expression, a new personal experience? Can the average person, meaning you and me, actually stand as an exemplar? Yes, all we have to do to solve the problems in our homes and in our world is gather the will to do so. And that occurs spontaneously in species that understand who they are and what they are. There are such advanced beings in the universe. They live in a different way, having long ago, in the earlier stages of their civilization's development, presumably the stage at which we are now, made their daring decision. They chose to recognize that the essential essence, which some of us call God, was the singular ingredient of which they were comprised, and never to think of themselves in any other way. The wonderful words of Maya Angelou come to mind here. When we know better, we do better. Humanity is now getting to the place where we are beginning to know better. So each of us can choose, even if others do not, to know what human nature really is and to express and experience it. Then, even as we understand children whose immaturity and confusion leads to some of their actions, so too will we see that the same is true of adults who act in childish and hurtful ways. We'll be clear that they don't know any better. we don't feel a deep need to forgive children when they behave childishly. The key I've talked about, the compassion I've described, arises naturally when we see their immaturity and confusion. We then find ourselves actually comforting them should they break the cherished family heirloom or play with matches and create mayhem. This is an appropriate response with children. But is it with adults? Does it make sense to address the growing alienation of fully grown humans in this way? Should we approach even those who have hurt us or actually tried to kill us and shake hands with them? I mean, what in the world was the Pope thinking? Perhaps he was considering this. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. And as for actually bestowing a blessing on the prisoner, perhaps these were the Pope's thoughts. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Comments, questions, anyone? Is there some lack of clarity about what Jesus might have meant here? Jesus was not the only one to suggest that we love our enemies. The Buddha, sitting centuries before him, advised his monks in the now famous Parable of the Saw that even if bandits were to savagely sever them limb by limb with a double-handled saw, quote, even then, whoever of you harbors ill will at heart would not be upholding my teaching, unquote. He taught them to remain full of concern and pity for the attackers with a mind of love and not to give in to hatred. And there have been other messengers as well, both ancient and contemporary, from widely varied cultural traditions, who have extended to us exactly the same invitation. So these are not new ideas. But what may be new in this present day is your determination to find a way to place those ideas into your life at the next level. Yet the messages themselves are not enough. We need something else, something more, something new. We need to make a major choice, a daring decision. We need to choose God to be experienced as a part of us. This means consciously adopting, embracing, accepting, expressing, and experiencing that we are spiritual beings physically manifesting and one essence manifesting individually. And what is the method by which we can do that? We've talked over and over about making that decision. So now the question is, how does that work? How do we express that choice in our daily life? How do we make that part of our moment-to-moment experience? Chapter 27, The Experience. Okay, what follows needn't be complicated or difficult. It can be challenging for sure, but challenging and difficult are not the same thing. Anyone who has learned to ski and has done it well knows the difference. Anyone who has learned to make French crepe sucré and has done it well knows the difference. Anyone who has learned to speak a new language and has done it well knows the difference. That which is continually difficult can be draining. That which is continually challenging can be invigorating. That's the difference. Stepping into the living of your life as a spiritual being, physically manifesting, can be challenging. But it will be wonderfully invigorating once you feel the difference between moving through your life this way and the way most of us have moved through our lives until we made this decision. Stepping into the living of your life as one essence manifesting individually can be even more challenging, because it places you on the fast track of your evolutionary process. But it can be even more than just invigorating. It can be revitalizing, reviving, restoring, regenerating, resuscitating, rejuvenating, reestablishing. It reestablishes your true identity, an identity you may have set aside after you were told the old cultural story about who you are and what human nature is, and you accepted all of that as truth, even though it was not. You now know that it is not human nature to think first of your own survival. That is not human nature to refuse compassion. That it is not human nature to remain separate. And that it is definitely not human nature to feel alienation. You now know that being less than marvelously magnificent, less than wonderfully wise, less than completely clear, less than daringly divine, is not human nature, but just the opposite. Because we now know better, we can all now do better. We can now implement, actualize, enact our highest thoughts about who and what we are, turning them from concept to experience in our daily reality. This is the natural next step in our evolution. Let me offer from the For What It's Worth department three tools that I've found to be wonderfully helpful as I seek not just to know but to express that I am a spiritual being living in a physical body, and that we are all individuations of a single essence. I don't use these tools as often as I would like. It's a matter of discipline, an area in which I am growing, but I'm better at it now than I ever was before. So I'm going to give myself that pat on the back and encourage myself to keep on keeping on. I invite you to do the same, whatever process and methods you might use. Tool number one offers me a way to embrace the first aspect of my true nature, that I am not just a physical entity, but a spiritual being. Because I choose to express myself as a spiritual being, I have begun asking myself a simple but powerful question several times a day. You could call it my beingness question. I ask this question internally if I am thinking of watching a television program or going to a movie. I ask it of myself if I am invited to a gathering of some kind. I pose the question if I am browsing through my books to find something to read, or browsing through my fridge to find something to eat. I try to remember to ask it of myself before I make any decision that's going to create an experience of myself in a particular way on this particular day. I also ask it if I'm encountering a particularly difficult or frustrating moment. Perhaps a plan of mine isn't going well, or perhaps I'm having a tiff with a loved one. Here's the question. What does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? Almost instantly, whenever I ask myself that question, I get my answer. Either what I'm about to do or say resonates with my soul's agenda, or it does not. And I know it immediately. And I see the choice that is before me as an opportunity for growth, for expanding into the full experience of my true nature. If I'm experiencing one of life's difficult moments, the answer to my beingness question allows me to see such a moment in a new way as well, not as an obstacle, but as an opportunity for growth. Now, I know that may sound just shy of unbelievably trite, but growth can actually become a welcome and exciting prospect when I understand what I am doing here. That is why I came to Earth. I came here for growth. I came here for expansion. And I came here as a part of an eternal journey that does not begin and end with my birth and death in this lifetime. For me to transform every moment of choice in my life from seeming meaninglessness to being meaningful, and every moment of difficulty in my life from seeming disagreeable to being agreeable, I must be clear that the agenda of my soul is to recreate myself anew in every golden moment of now, in the next grandest version of the greatest vision ever I held about who I am. In other words, creation. Continual creation. Continual creation of the self, which we ultimately realize is not self-creation in the truest sense at all, but in the truest sense, self-realization. We are not actually creating who we are, but coming to know and experience who we are at the next level. Given an awareness of the agenda, which I believe to be the agenda we all share, called evolution, I have placed at my fingertips a way to experience myself as a spiritual being. I simply contextualize my daily encounters and choices within a new framework, the framework formed by my spiritual identity and my spiritual purpose, both of which are eternal. Tool number two is the making of a firm commitment to strive to experience that aspect of myself that I know to be one essence manifesting individually. I have found it easier than I ever thought it could be by asking myself a different question at very specific points in my day. These are moments when I feel myself moved by emotion, either positively or negatively, as I observe, experience, or notice someone or something that appears to be separate from me. It could be a sunset, or a sudden and scary windstorm. It could be another person being wonderfully caring of me and very loving. Or it could be an insistence, such as I described earlier, when a person is being aggressive and maybe even a little confronting. It could be someone whose behavior I am observing at a distance or across the room. Whatever it is I am observing that I notice is bringing up the emotion in me, I ask myself a second question that I may, if I wish, combine with the first. You could call this my oneness question. Here's the question. Is there any part of what I am now seeing over there that I have seen over here in myself? If I see a beautiful and glorious sunset, is there a part of me that is beautiful and glorious, of which it arouses an awareness in me? If I hear of a person who has been unbelievably courageous, perhaps someone who has run out into traffic and saved someone's life, is there a part of me that is unbelievably courageous, of which it arouses an awareness in me? If I see or hear of a person who is being or has been domineering or self-serving or even unkind and hurtful? Is there a part of me that is or has been domineering or self-serving or even unkind and hurtful that it arouses an awareness of in me? Whether I'm observing something or someone magnificent, or something or someone less than magnificent, I allow myself to see if I can find some version of that in myself. This, more than any other device or tool I've heard of or used, has helped me to feel, to actually experience, the part of me that's being shown to me. If and when I see myself outside of myself, it is then that I realize that there is no such place. I see that outside of myself does not exist, that there is nothing outside of myself, that I do not find inside of myself at some level, to some degree, in some proportion. And it is then that I can experience and show true compassion for the person in whom I see the same thing larger, or perhaps the same thing smaller. Ultimately, I stop measuring. I stop comparing to see who's larger or smaller in the ways that I am. I stop looking to see who's better or worse, or who's more or less. I see only me outside of me, acting out a part of me that's inside of me, that I have experienced there. If it's a part of me that pleases me and it brings me joy to think of myself in that way, I determine to demonstrate more of that as my life goes on. If it is a part of me with which I am not pleased and it saddens me to think of myself in that way, I commit to demonstrating less and less of that as my life goes on. So if you want the experience of oneness and are not content to just dabble in the concept, and if you want the experience of your spirituality and are not content to just dabble in the concept, try these two questions sometime. See if they work for you as they have for me. Tool number 3 invites me to pay continuing attention to how this idea of choosing God to be experienced as a part of me can be recognized by me as having already been part of my life. I have come to see that I and you have already done this. We've simply called it something else. Some years ago, I wrote a book titled Communion with God. It was written entirely from God's point of view. And not long after it reached bookstores, reporters began calling me for interviews, many of them leading with the same question: where do you get off speaking in the first-person voice of God? Isn't that more than a little presumptuous? It's another one of those fair questions. While I am not the first person to have produced such a book, far from it, in fact, inquiring minds still want to know, how can I, or for that matter, anyone, dare to place words in God's mouth in this way? The first thing I answer when asked this question is that I am not placing words in God's mouth. God is placing words in mine. Furthermore, God is doing the same thing with all of us. I am not the only person on the planet speaking God's words. All of us are in communion with God all of the time. All of us, including you, have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever spoken of love to any other person, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever spoken of compassion to a person in need of compassion, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever spoken of forgiveness to a person who seeks forgiveness, or even to one who does not, perhaps especially to one who does not, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever argued for fairness, called for justice, pleaded for peace, recommended mercy, or proposed a win-win solution to anyone, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever consoled or comforted, encouraged or motivated, uplifted or congratulated, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever renewed another's faith, especially in themselves, restored another's hope, revived another's dream, confirmed another's greatness, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. If you have ever respected another's truth, resolved another's doubt, removed another's fear, recalled another's goodness, recited another's attributes, reduced another's apprehension, relieved another's mind, or remained another's friend, you have spoken in the first-person voice of God. It is not difficult to speak in the first-person voice of God. It is more difficult not to. You have to step away from, you have to abandon your true nature. When you let God place words in your mouth, you always speak the truth. You always speak with sensitivity and awareness. You always speak of how to resolve, not who to blame. You always speak your mind, but you always speak from the heart. And you always speak with the wisdom and gentleness of your soul. You speak your truth, but soothe your words with peace. Every moment is a moment of communion with God. And we can experience it as that if we consciously reject from separation theology and choose God to be part of us. So, as you speak the words you speak today, whatever those words might be, ask yourself, is this what I want the world to hear from God right now? Imagine what your life would be like if you decided that every word you uttered was the word of God. Does that feel like too much responsibility? Is that more than you wish to carry on your shoulders? Well, too bad, because every word you utter is the word of God, unless the essence of you and the essence of God are completely separated and are not one, in which case everything you've read in this book is out the window. Yet I can understand how it could feel like a lot of responsibility. But what if you did not see this as a burden, but rather as an opportunity? What if you saw it as your chance to simply step into your grandest thought about what divinity is in any and every moment that you choose to do so? If you saw it as that, as an invitation, not a requirement, your whole life could suddenly become a great adventure. Each day you would awaken with massive excitement, asking yourself, what does God want to say to the world today, through me? That's an intriguing question, isn't it? I mean, supposing you were to ask yourself that every morning, what does God want to say to the world today, through me? So I invite all of us today to look a little more closely at what we are putting out into the world, and to see if, perhaps, we may want to make a little adjustment. You know, here or there, once in a while, now and then, to bring our pronouncements closer to God's announcements. Does that feel to you like a worthy experiment for you to undertake this week? I think you'll find that all three of these tools can be very impactful in your life, really helping you to not just conceptualize yourself as a spiritual being physically manifesting and one essence manifesting individually, but to experience yourself as that. Actually, there is a whole list of ways you can do this. I've left that for our finale. Chapter 28, the finale. We're all doing our best here, but let's not kid each other. This is not an easy road that we're traveling. The journey from birth to death is no picnic. It can be more joyful, more fulfilling, and more wonderful if we know who and what we are. If we know that we are, in fact, spiritual beings and one being. Sadly, no one has told this in school. No one taught us this at our place of worship. No one discussed this at the dinner table in our home. No one supplied us with the information when we were young to prepare us to enter into adult life. This is the info they never gave us. And so, we had no accurate idea, if we had any idea at all, of how we got here or where we're going after we leave here, much less how we can make it all work while we're here. Now, here in this little book, I've offered what I hope you have found to be some compelling information about what's going on here on the planet and why, and some useful suggestions on ways that all of us can express and experience our true nature in spite of what's going on, and thus begin to change what's going on. Let me present here, as a finale to this exploration, an actual list of such ways. This list was given to us in the text of the book, Conversations with God, Book 4, Awaken the Species. It describes 16 differences in the behavior of an awakened species when compared to the behavior of humans living in an unawakened state. I am reprinting that list here because I believe that humanity benefits enormously when helpful information is repeated as often as possible. Let us see then what it would be like to experience our true nature at the highest level. 1. An awakened species sees the unity of all life and lives into it. Humans in an unawakened state often deny it or ignore it. 2. An awakened species tells the truth always. Humans in an unawakened state too often lie to themselves as well as others. 3. An awakened species says one thing and will do what they say. Humans in an unawakened state often say one thing and do another. 4. An awakened species, having seen and acknowledged what is so, will always do what works. Humans in an unawakened state often do the opposite. 5. An awakened species does not embrace a principle in its civilization that correlates with the concepts that humans refer to as justice and punishment. 6. An awakened species does not embrace a principle in its civilization that correlates with the concept that humans refer to as insufficiency. 7. An awakened species does not embrace a principle in its civilization that correlates with the concept that humans refer to as ownership. 8. An awakened species shares everything with everyone all the time. Humans in an unawakened state often do not, only sharing with others in limited circumstances. 9. An awakened species creates a balance between technology and cosmology, between machines and nature. Humans in an unawakened state often do not. 10. An awakened species would never, under any circumstances, terminate the current physical expression of another sentient being unless asked directly by that other being to do so. Humans in an unawakened state often kill other humans without that other human requesting them to. 11. An awakened species would never do anything that could potentially damage or harm the physical environment that supports the members of the species when they are physicalized. Humans in an unawakened state often do so. 12. An awakened species never poisons itself. Humans in an unawakened state often do so. 13. An awakened species never competes. Humans in an unawakened state are often in competition with each other. 14. An awakened species is clear that it needs nothing. Humans in an unawakened state often create a need-based experience. 15. An awakened species experiences and expresses unconditional love for everyone. Humans in an unawakened state often cannot imagine even a deity who does this, much less do they do it themselves. 16. An awakened species has harnessed the power of metaphysics. Humans in an unawakened state often largely ignore it. I believe that all of the behaviors of a fully awakened species will spontaneously arise in humans when we choose the essential essence that we call divinity to be experienced as a part of us and as that of which all beings and all aspects of life are comprised. I believe that our personal decisions and choices, actions, and priorities will change dramatically when we inwardly confirm that our presence of the Spirit of God within is a normal aspect of our daily life, and then decide to recognize divinity at last for what it has always been, our true nature. You yourself are the evidence of this. I want to make these points once again so that you never forget them. You have not been told this often enough. Indeed, some religions have actually told all of us that we are sinners, that we were born in sin, original sin, it has been called, and that we are far from divine. Yet the fact that God lives within you is revealed in every gift of self you have ever offered, in any form, to any other person whose life you have touched with the miracle of love. For if love expressed through you is not the evidence of God in you, then nothing is. Divinity shines through you every time someone is brightened by your smile, every time someone is restored by your recognition of their gifts, every time someone is renewed by your honoring of their virtues and your reminder of their worthiness, and surely every time someone is remembered with love in your heart. In these moments, you couldn't deny the presence of divinity within you if you tried. You feel it, you know it, and whatever your personal philosophy or theology allows you to call it, you deeply understand that it is your true nature. You have been in many, many moments of your life, goodness and mercy and compassion and understanding. You have been forgiveness and patience, strength and courage, a helper in someone's time of need, a comforter in someone's time of sorrow, a healer in someone's time of injury, a teacher in someone's time of confusion. You have been in many moments the deepest wisdom and the highest truth, the greatest companion and the greatest love. Your soul knows who you are, and now your mind is choosing to accept what your soul has known and been telling you all along. You are a spiritual being manifesting physically and one essence manifesting individually. This is an essence shared by everyone and everything in existence. Is there any remaining doubt as to what this essence is? No. So be it. I mean that literally. So be it. I am Raymond Posch, and we are coming to the end of this show. Please note my apologies that, due to time constraints, I cut out several minutes of content from the last chapter. I want to again urge everyone to obtain a copy of The Essential Path and read it in entirety. There will be a part 4 in the next show, in which I may read one or two of the skipped chapters, and then I and my guest, Donnie Rongo, will discuss our conclusions from the book and our hopes for humanity to fully embrace oneness and a new way of being in the world. Please check out my coaching programs at liveyoursuccess.com and sign up for the free vision webinar so that you can bring your dreams to life.